Welcome, welcome. A really warm welcome for everybody. Wherever you are, whomever you are. Sometimes when we listen to a Dharma talk or give a Dharma talk, there's this tendency to approach them with our cognitive minds. I know that certainly is the case for me sometimes. Been reflecting on this, and for many of us who have had a profession or just enjoy kind of like solving problems, figuring things out, acquiring knowledge, understanding it, and creating models from the data that we get. Or I know that my years as a research scientist, I used to love that so much. Love that when to get the data and like, wow, okay, now what does this mean? And put together the little pieces. And there's so many different ways in which we might do this, whether we're actually doing experiments or not. And so, of course, we or sometimes we'll bring this type of thinking or this type of way of being into the way we approach Dharma talks, either giving the Dharma talks or listening to them. Trying to, might be a way, like if we're listening to them, we might have this idea that, okay, well just if I just take in enough information, if I understand it, if I can make all the little pieces fit together, nice, neat, and tidy. Or maybe if I can, the sense of, okay, if I just have to get everything straight, now how does this relate to that? And what precisely is the definition of that? And this energy of trying to figure it out, and this feeling, this maybe leaning into, well, if only I just had it, all the information, then I could do this Buddhist practice thing. I could do this meditation thing. Of course, it's easy for us to fall into that type of thinking when we have it probably in so many other areas of our lives. And in some ways and sometimes that type of approach of figuring it out or acquiring information is helpful with our Buddhist practice, is helpful with meditation. But it's not the only way. And nor is it have to be the predominant way. There's so many different ways in which we might listen to a Dharma talk or just approach the Dharma in general. So one way that also this cognitive, really intellectualized approach may also approach listening to Dharma talks is not only trying to figure it out, but also there might be this little niggling thought, okay, surely it's not really that simple. It must be more complicated. So this always this thinking that there's got to be more here. This idea of mindfulness just being with our experience. Surely that can't be enough. Paying attention to one's breath. Surely there's got to be more. That doesn't seem snazzy enough. So there's this way in which we might be tempted to substitute knowledge for practice. Thinking that if we acquire information or thinking that we have to figure it out. But there's a way in which practice can be actually really simple. Really simple. One way we might think about it is maybe can be demonstrated with this simile. Perhaps some of you are familiar with this simile that's in the suttas. So we might, and the Buddha tells the story as a way to make a point, that suppose there's a crowd of people who are watching a performance, a really beguiling interesting performance, and their attention is there, and maybe there's a, in my mind, there's like an upbeat mood, maybe there's a, yeah, there's just like and in my mind, it's kind of like, you know, sometimes we see concerts, rock and roll concerts or something like this, pop concerts. So there's these people that are happily watching a performance. And then we can imagine that you have been instructed to carry a bowl of oil on your head and to walk through the crowd towards the stage without dropping the oil from the bowl. And just to make it a little more interesting, there's a person behind you with a sword that will cut off your head if any drop of oil falls. It's a little bit outrageous even to imagine this. But the Buddha is pointing to, this is one way we might consider mindfulness practice. That is, if you're going to walk with a bowl of oil on your head, that there's like some hustle and bustle going around you, and people are paying attention to the performance, not to you. That means you need to have some mindfulness. You need to be aware, and to be aware of your posture so that you remain balanced. But there also needs to be some flexibility and some agility, and to be aware of what's going around, but around you. Maybe not so much that you like are turning your head to look and see everything, but in a way in which maybe your awareness is kind of broad. So it has to be like really embodied with a sense of agility or a sense of flexibility and stability to walk through this crowd with a bowl of oil on your head. And then we might consider that the sword, the person with the sword on the that's going to chop off your head, is more pointing to the to be sustained, to have this sustained mindfulness. So it's not to be upright with good posture and balanced in a sense of agility once or twice, but the entire time you're walking towards the stage. And I'm imagining, I don't know, but I'm imagining in the Buddha's time, maybe it wasn't so unusual to walk with a bowl of or walk with anything on your head. So maybe it doesn't have the same degree of difficulty that it might for us. But again, pointing to this sense of embodiment and awareness. So if this were to be a simile that points to practice, we could say, well, actually, in some ways, the practice is simple. Be aware and stay balanced. Be aware and stay balanced. But we might also hear about some of this person in the sword, in the back of us with a sword. And we might consider there would be some tension and some tightness about this, not flexibility or agility or something like this. So maybe to bring in another visual, you know, sometimes we can understand things with a visual, with similes and stories. And even though Buddhism and Buddhist practice certainly has a lot of lists, there's also these stories and these visual things, so that's a little bit what I'd like to use today. So here's another visual. That there is a monastic who is feeling really discouraged and feels like they want to leave the monastery, want to disrobe. And this person was... And before they became a monastic, would play the lute. We can think of the lute as a proto-guitar. It's in the guitar family, perhaps. And so when the Buddha hears that this person, Sona, wants to leave the monastery and disrobe, he goes to Sona and says, "So Sona, You were a lute player, right? Yes, Venerable Sir. Well, when the string was too loose, did it sound good? No, Venerable Sir. Well, what about when the string was too tight? Did it sound good? No, Venerable Sir. So in the same way, tune your level of effort so that it's just right. In the same way that you would tune the strings of a guitar so that it has the right sound, tune the level of effort. That is, to not be too tight and striving and straining, and not to be too lackadaisical. And one thing that's nice about the simile of the lute is if we think about the lutes have more than one string, I don't know exactly how many, but that when we know with guitars that when you tune one string, then you tune other strings to that string. So that everything comes into harmony. So you can pay attention in particular to one string, and then everything else, it becomes a little bit easier to tune all the others. So to pay attention to the amount of energy, the amount of effort, and maybe one way that is an indicator for how much effort one is applying is your reaction when the bell rings at the end of a meditation period. When the bell rings and there's a sense of, oh, then that's a sign that there's a little bit too much tightness and maybe too much straining or a little bit too much a sense of white knuckling it till the end of the period, the meditation period. So we need to tune our energy. We need to have some agility. But also, maybe to emphasize this sense of maybe a little bit of movement, here's one other simile. Or I'm sorry, this isn't a simile. This is a little story in which a deva, this is an unembodied being, comes to the Buddha and says, "Dear sir, how did you cross the flood?" And we could use the word flood to represent all kinds of things. But without saying anything specific, we know that floods are generally undesirable, that they kind of like destroy things in their path and have a lot of power and are maybe the product of torrential rains or something. "Dear sir, how did you cross the flood?" "I crossed the flood by not halting and not straining." And then the deva says, "But how, by not halting and by not straining, did you cross the flood?" And the Buddha responds, "When I came to a standstill, I sank. And when I struggled, I got swept away." So to not do anything, to sink, but to put forward a lot of effort, a lot of energy, struggling, fighting, is to get swept away in this torrential flood. To not find a way across, but to be susceptible to the energy of the flood itself. So these are some visuals in which we might understand practice, where we might really simplify practice. Be aware and stay balanced. I heard this from another Dharma teacher. Be aware and stay balanced. So what does this mean, stay balanced? I talked about this a little bit in the guided meditation. One way is with our posture, whether we're sitting or walking, or whether we're moving. I guess you don't worry about your posture so much when you're lying down in terms of being balanced, but it's really worthwhile to spend some time learning which kind of seating equipment is best and to really learn, is our ears over our shoulders sometimes having to tuck the chin a little bit so that it opens up a little space in the back of the neck, so that the spine has a real sense of uprightness and allows the arms to just hang. But as we are sitting, we might notice during meditation, if we have this intention to check our posture, we might notice that sometimes there's a certain amount of leaning. It can be leaning forward, maybe not so much literally, but maybe kind of like figuratively leaning backwards. This kind of like a push and a pull, a sense of a push and a pull that we feel in the body, as well as we feel in the mind. But this leaning, we can maybe, if we notice that we're leaning, might be an encouragement to inquire, well, what are we placing our attention on? What are we aware of? Because sometimes our minds fixate on what we want or what we don't want. And then this kind of causes us to lean, either literally or figuratively, this push or pull. But mindfulness practice is to be aware of this preoccupation with what we want or with what we don't want. As of course it's a natural human impulse to be preoccupied with these things and trying to fix them. But we can be aware of our mental state rather than just letting them continue, like unchecked. But to be aware and stay balanced is to notice, when are we a little bit out of balance? So to be leaning towards something, to be wanting something, to have desire for something, it's not inherently problematic. We all have the desire to eat when we're hungry. We have the desire to care for and protect those people we love. We have a desire for the world to be a better place. We have a desire for practice and to find more freedom, experience more freedom. So desire by itself isn't inherently problematic, but this, our practice is about becoming aware and being able to distinguish between skillful and unskillful desire. A desire that leads to more and more freedom, or the desire that lends to getting tangled up and leading to less freedom. So practice isn't about getting rid of all desire, even though sometimes I have heard some Buddhist teachings that made me think that perhaps it was, but this recognition of what's skillful and what's unskillful. Sometimes we can notice that by whether we feel out of balance or not. And if we notice that we're a little bit of out of balance with our desire, one thing we can do is to take a careful look at the object of our desire. The actual thing or the situation. And to just do this gentle inquiry, are we seeing it accurately? Chances are when we have a lot of desire, we're just seeing all the beautiful aspects, all the attractive aspects. But everything has, you know, it's not, the chances are that something is 100% beautiful is not high. So can we see the fullness? Can we see some of the unattractive aspects of whatever we're desiring? And can we take and imagine, will this really fulfill these expectations that I have? And asking that question, ask us, well, what are our expectations that we have for whatever it is that we're desiring? And then that kind of brings us back to our own experience. So there's the object. Is it really as beautiful and perfect as we're imagining? And what is my experience? Both what are my expectations and how does it feel to be desiring? How does it feel to be like leaning, this pulling, being pulled towards something? And it might be really subtle, this way that we're maybe a little bit off balance in a subtle way. So to simplify the practice, to be aware and stay balanced, one way that we might be out of balance is because we're filled with desire. And of course, the flip side of that is aversion. This mild or maybe even really strong dislike or really sense of, I don't want this. And just like with desire, there are healthy forms of aversion. And in some ways, it might even be a kindness to turn away from some things that are painful. And there are times also when we're just, for so many different reasons, not quite ready to work with some particular difficulties or have that particular difficult conversation. So we feel like, okay, it's the time isn't quite right. So that's perfectly natural. So not every single time that there's an aversion, there's a turning away, doesn't mean that it's bad. And again, practice is about learning to discern when is it helpful and when isn't it helpful. But aversion also can be mixed in with a little bit of hostility and have some ill will. That, of course, is not helpful. And it's when we're a little bit out of balance. So this kind of a push, maybe like a really strong pushing away. So to work with this, can we just be with this aversion or ill will without trying to fix it? Can we just notice, oh yeah, that's what's happening right now. I'm aware this is what's happening. I'm aware I'm a little bit out of balance. And then sometimes when we're just bringing awareness, some open-hearted awareness, we come back into balance. Also, similar to desire, when we're the invitation is to look really closely at the object and to see, is this really going to satisfy our expectations? So maybe when there's some aversion, maybe to do a little bit of an imagination. How would you feel if you acted out your aversion, your ill will? Maybe there'd be some regret, maybe there'd be some remorse, or maybe there's a sense of, oh yeah, okay, the wise thing to do here is not to get tangled up with that, but to come back here to center. So to just check in and to use our imagination about A, it's the objects, as well as be how we feel, and just to notice also, how does it feel to have aversion? There's often a real sense of tightness and constriction, and a sense of maybe collapsing, or it's the opposite of open and spacious. And then also, we don't want to have aversion towards aversion, because that just perpetuates aversion. So is there a way and that we can just recognize and allow? Ah, yes, here's aversion. I'm a little bit off balance here because I have some aversion. So that's one way that kind of this leaning maybe that literally or metaphorically might be one way we're a little bit out of balance. But another way it might be kind of like energetically. That is, there might be this like a lot of restlessness. There might be a sense of we want to jump up and run away. Or maybe there's a sense of ping pong balls inside that are bouncing around. So this agitation or maybe a real scatteredness in the mind can't really settle anywhere. Whether also this kind of, there can be a really subtle way in which the mind is like quietly searching for something more interesting. So rather than kind of like landing on the object, like the breath, instead there's this kind of like this probing, this looking for what's next. Maybe a type of foraging or something like this. It can be a really subtle type of restlessness, which maybe feels, I don't know if I would use the word out of balance because it's very subtle, but it is out of balance when you compare it to the experience of just really being here, like completely here with our experience. And so when we have this restlessness, we might again use our imagination to work with it. One thing that sometimes I like to do is to imagine stepping into a cathedral. I was in Rome. It's now quite a long time ago. But I remember that sense of awe of stepping into this magnificent cathedral, these really high ceilings and the sense of space. So it's not that the restlessness has to go away, but now that same energetic feeling, but in a big space, it's a way that kind of like is a sense of calming. And be a sense of settling, like there's room for the restlessness to be. So that's one way to work with restlessness. Another way might be to kind of like zoom in and how does it feel in the body? And to just really get curious about the jaggedy feeling that goes with the restlessness. And then, of course, energetics, the opposite of restlessness, is a sense of dullness in the mind, in the body, a sense of maybe collapsed energy, a sense of just not enough energy, and maybe kind of like literally or figuratively collapsing, not enough energy to sit up, not enough energy to really be with the objects, but instead just kind of a foggy, detached way. So maybe there might like an absence of vitality is a way to describe it. And it might show up in our mind as just kind of retreating a little bit from what we're wanting to pay attention to, rather than arousing just enough energy to pay attention. And when we find ourselves in this, I might call it sloth and torpor, when we find ourselves with this, we might investigate what's underlying it. Often there's been a not quite paying attention, that there's been some discontent, a bit of aversion, some boredom, which is also a little bit of aversion. Maybe there's also just some physical tiredness from the body not being half enough sleep. Or maybe sometimes there might be some of this shutting down or lack of vitality when there's some really difficult emotions that we don't quite feel ready or capable to be with. And so there can be this collapsing. So we can really simplify our practice without having to use exclusively kind of like thinking about it, but to use imagery and use experiences in the body to be aware and stay balanced. And we might use this idea of balance in our posture as a way to point when we're a little bit off balance. And we can discover ways to come back into balance, but first is to just recognize, oh yeah, I'm leaning, or I'm bouncing or I'm collapsing. Kind of like use the kinesthetic, somatic experience as a way to point to when we're a little bit out of balance. And of course, the more we are in balance, the more we can respond appropriately, not only to what's actually happening to us, but what's happening to others, so that we may be able to support others and help them. So in this way, our practice can be a benefit not only for ourselves, but for others. Thank you.